Check, check.
Hey, check, hey.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me is James.
Yes, I'm here.
Just before we get started, we want to direct you to our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've been putting out a lot of podcasts recently. This week has been a particularly busy week with podcasts about the end of Breaking Bad. We don't know what happened yet, but I'm excited to find out in a couple days or 3 days ago. And yeah, also follow us on Twitter at The MacGuffin Man. And I recently wrote a thing about Shailene Woodley and Michael B. Jordan and how we decide young actors are good or not. Anyway, check all that out. But if you thought we weren't going to do another Godfather podcast, nuts to you, McGillicuddy.
Welcome to The MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James, what are we talking about today?
We are talking about Godfather Part 3.
Yeah, and just before we get into it, I don't know if this is picking up on the track, but there appear to be some power tools being used in the floor below us, so we apologize for that right off the top, but we can only do so much. But the Godfather 3.
The third one.
Yes.
The Fredo of the trilogy. Okay. Have you heard what Artie Lang told Robert Duvall about this movie?
No.
Said, when you buy the Godfather set, you get two DVDs to watch and one to do coke off of.
That's a pretty Artie Lang thing to say.
It is, but it also expresses the sentiment that this is seen as the very widely held worst of the three.
Oh, well, yeah, for sure. It's definitely the worst of the three, but I don't think it's a bad movie by any means.
Yeah, well, when the first two are considered some of the best movies ever made, yep, it's hard for the third one to really hold a candle to it, I guess.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so this was, 24 years after the second one? 76 to...
That doesn't sound right. 74 to... This came out in 1990, right?
Yep.
So 16 years.
No.
Yeah? Yep. That's how math works, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, let's go with that. It's the correct answer.
Yeah. Assuming it came out in 1990, which I think it did.
It did. Yeah. I know that much. Okay. I just don't know basic math.
Okay. I know movie trivia, not actual skills.
Yeah, so after the second one, I guess Francis Ford Coppola wasn't dying to do a third one.
Yeah.
Had some financial problems that needed to be addressed.
Yeah, well, Apocalypse Now is his follow-up to Godfather 2, right?
I think so.
Because, yeah, and Apocalypse Now is so infamous for kind of bankrupting Francis Ford Coppola. Yeah. And
being a disaster of a shoot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's always sort of been the type to sort of put his money where his mouth is very quickly and recklessly. And so, yeah, it's not surprising that at one point it caught up to him. And, yeah, it did. And, yes. and we got the Godfather 3 out of it. Yeah. I guess is an all right way to go bankrupt.
Yeah, I guess.
Get to make a movie with Al Pacino.
Yeah. No, well, yeah, this was his way of getting out of bankruptcy.
Yeah, exactly.
Not his way of going bankrupt.
Sorry, yeah.
One from the Heart, are you familiar with that movie?
I've never seen it, but I'm familiar with the ruin. Is that the musical he made with Tom Waits?
Yeah, Tom Waits did the soundtrack, yeah. Yeah, it made about, I think, 2.5% of its budget back,
okay,
which is seen as
small.
One of the worst return on investments in film history. Yeah. This Godfather 3 is kind of seen as his, what was supposed to be kind of a surefire moneymaker.
Yeah.
And, you know, number one and two made so much money and were so well-received critically that it just, you know, kind of made sense that this would be what you go to if you're hoping to make some money.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like, Paramount was not like, nah, we don't want to do a third one. It was more that it was like them banging on the door, like just trying to get Coppola to finally relent.
Yeah, and so this was kind of, you know, doomed from the beginning for a few reasons. Yeah.
It was very rushed, right? That's my understanding of the production.
Yeah, Francis Ford Coppola wanted to work on the screenplay with Mario Puzo, who wrote the novels for the first two. And they requested 6 months to complete a first draft of the script and wanted it out in Easter 91. And Paramount said, we'll give you 6 weeks for a script. And they didn't have a holiday release for Christmas 1990. So they said, that's your release date.
Gotcha.
So they had a lot less time to make it for a lot less money and said, we're not going to pay for anything over the budget. So that'll be you paying for it. So, and he was in personal financial trouble at this point, Coppola. So, yeah, they did not have the time, money, really any of the resources to do this.
Okay, yeah.
Robert Duvall was asked to come back, but asked for too much money, and so they just wrote him out of the script. Yeah. So
he's dead.
Yeah. Well, and Coppola even said the movie feels incomplete without Robert Duvall's character.
I think he said that many years later, I think.
Yeah.
I think that's sort of like the re-release Blu-ray edition with commentary tracks.
Do you find him noticeably absent?
Yes. I mean, it's hard to deny. Yeah.
And you really like Duvall in the first ones.
Yeah. And we both talked about how fascinating we find Tom. And it's sort of like, and this movie doesn't even really try and establish, I don't even remember what the lawyer's name is in this. I know it's George Hamilton. That's about it.
Yeah. It's
because it's like, we've got too many things going on. We don't have time to establish this guy as a character. And that's the whole thing. It's all about, like The Godfather 2 is very much about consequences. This is even more about consequences.
Yes.
And we don't have time to set up another character for them to have consequences in a movie we'll never make. So he just has to be a generic lawyer.
Yeah. And really fleshing out his character would just take away from the other character. So he kind of just does his thing, which is very little. Yeah. I refuse to work with you.
Okay. Great. Like Robert Duvall refused to work with Francis Ford Coppola again. And yes, I feel Tom is missing, and I assume you do as well.
Yeah, and just because he's so good, and his role is still there, just in a totally mediocre, bland way.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, if there's any movie where you knew Robert Duvall had a part in it and then just wasn't in it, then you're going to be like, oh, I wish this movie had some Robert Duvall. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we have a few new characters in this one. Mary.
Yeah.
Corleone.
Not really new characters.
Yeah, but speaking for the first time. Exactly. And having a personality and something to do.
Yeah, exactly.
And Vincent Mancini would be obviously a big one.
The other big one, yeah. Are we just going to get this out of the way? I fucking hate Andy Garcia in this movie.
Yeah, let's get this out of the way.
Like, how do you feel about Andy Garcia in this movie?
Even before really seeing the Godfather movies, I always thought Andy Garcia was just the poor man's Al Pacino.
Everybody's always thought that, but I guess it's because of this movie that they think
that. But that's why I say this was even before that, that I kind of thought of this on my own, and I'm not saying I was the first one to ever think that, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I don't like him.
Yeah.
I kind of like him a little bit in parts of this, but
no.
Overall, I'm just not a fan of him. And it's, you know, it could be a very cool role for somebody. And it's obviously in a very big franchise. Yep. And yeah, I don't hate Sofia Coppola as much as other people seem to.
I don't know either.
She's
certainly not a good actress, but I think Andy Garcia's performance is so much more important to the movie.
That's why I find it interesting that she gets so much of the hate about this movie, is that
people hate nepotism.
Yeah, but it's throughout this whole series.
What do you mean?
Isn't there Coppola's all over the first two?
Yeah, no, exactly. Well? This is the only one where, and I mean, Talia Shire, if her last name was Coppola, would maybe have more of a problem. But
and had more of, I mean, Sofia Coppola had some limited acting experience up to this point.
Exactly. But. And my take on, and I want to get back to Andy Garcia. I'm not done making fun of him yet. But my take on the Sofia Coppola thing is it goes back to the Rush production. And Winona Ryder was the person that came the closest to playing the role, correct?
Yeah, I think that's how it is. There was a couple of names that were very close. It was her, Julia Roberts, they wanted to, who doesn't seem to fit in this family at all.
Not at all.
Rebecca Schaefer, who was murdered before they had a chance to, incredibly. And I guess Madonna really wanted it, but was too old. So.
That was appropriately Italian.
Yeah, exactly. She's Italian enough, but I think she was like 12 years younger than her mom would have, like,
oh, really?
Her character's mom would have been, so it just didn't. And they'd already aged Al Pacino a bunch for this. And
yeah.
It's only so much you can do.
But my take on that is, and this is with the understanding that Winona Ryder was pretty close to actually playing the role and then dropped out.
Yes.
And so at this point, you know, they've got a release date, and apparently they have to hit that. Like, if you compress 6 months into 6 weeks of writing,
yes.
Like, there are going to be problems. And I think sort of Coppola was just sort of like, well, I could audition people, but I'd rather have somebody that I know at least I can trust. And I mean, if we look back in Coppola's career, he's had a lot of untrustworthy actors. Marlon Brando just didn't show up for a shoot day on The Godfather 2. Marlon Brando was there on The Godfather 1. and Apocalypse Now is just well known as a nightmare. Like, Martin Sheen's role was initially played by Harvey Keitel.
Yeah.
And again, Marlon Brando was there when he decided to be. You know, so I feel like he sort of was like, well, I've already got all this pressure on me. I'm going to let this relatively small part be played by somebody that I at least trust. You know?
Yeah, and...
And she's not a horrendous actress. She's not good.
Yeah, well, I was going to say Pantangelo in the second one, too, apparently was a big drunk and had problems. Like, we know Marlon Brando had similar things, too. Like, you're right, in his career, he has run into a lot of people that have just been very selfish and not considered the production or Coppola. So at least this one... And it sounded like he had to talk her into it a lot, and she was kind of reluctant to do it. But yeah, this is someone who's not going to fuck their dad over.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and put them further into financial ruin.
Yeah.
And she looks the part.
Yeah, I mean, she certainly looks like a Corleone.
Yeah. I mean, people have a lot of issues with her acting, like, apparently. But yeah, I'd say she's not great, but she's not my problem with this movie.
No, exactly. Andy Garcia kind of drives me nuts. He is very much the poor man's Al Pacino, and maybe like the homeless man's dead friend's Al Pacino, you know? Like, I just don't like him. And I think I might have kind of liked him before I saw this movie for the first time.
I was going to say, do you like him in anything?
I think The Untouchables would have been the only thing I would have seen him in. And he's kind of badass in that movie from what I recall.
Yeah, he's good in that.
You know, I saw it when I was like 15 or something, so it's like
a good age to see The Untouchables.
Yeah, exactly. Before you realize that it's The Untouchables. But no, and I think that was sort of, and I was like, oh, cool. And then I saw this probably like a year later and was like, nope. You're out. You're out of the family.
Did you see anybody else who was competing for the role of Vincent Mancini?
No, I didn't, actually. I'd be fascinated to see some names.
Yeah, so what was the one? I guess Ivan Drago was the one where I had like 40 names taken from the IMDb trivia list.
Yeah.
So this is the same source, which is, you know,
sketchy at best.
Always take with a grain of salt.
On a couple of days ago, actually, somebody tweeted Rian Johnson, the director of Brick and Looper, a question about an IMDb trivia about the most recent Breaking Bad that he directed. And they're like, is this true, Rian? He's like, no, literally nothing on IMDb is true.
Literally nothing.
Yeah, he used the word literally. That is not my
choice.
Good
for him.
Yeah.
Well, according to the liar that is IMDb, LieMDB says that Alec Baldwin.
That's awesome.
Yes.
And Alec Baldwin was, like, legit good. I mean, he's still good now, but, like, he was leading man good at this point.
Yeah, and for kind of a dark character who has to be charming shit, too. Yeah. Baldwin could pull that off.
Yeah, for sure.
Matt Dillon.
Okay.
Vincent Spano.
I don't even know who that is.
Val Kilmer.
Nice.
I like that. I have a big soft spot.
I like it. I like the idea. I would not have liked it in practice.
And then these last three. Charlie Sheen.
Okay.
Billy Zane.
Sold. He's a cool dude.
And I swear to God, and this was put last, Nicolas Cage.
I love it.
I had a similar reaction.
That would have been awesome.
Yeah.
And this is like maybe, back when Nicolas Cage still tried really hard. So I can't imagine why that wouldn't have worked out.
Yeah, apparently they were up for the role.
I believe in our first Godfather podcast, I mentioned Al Pacino and then Nicolas Cage next to each other, sort of similar versions. Anyways, a lot of those names would have been fascinating. And
yeah.
Most of them are not Andy Garcia, so
yeah,
most if not all of them are not Andy Garcia.
He's just so bland. And his first little scene with his smirk and his leather jacket,
it's like
just
pushing the guy,
yeah, just instantly infuriated me.
And it's like he goes from doing like the whole arc of his performance is, and it's supposed to mirror Michael in the first one, but in sort of a different way. Like, he starts by doing a James Caan impression and ends up doing an Al Pacino impression. And it's supposed to be a transition between the two. And because he is Sonny's child. Al Pacino was a little better at that.
At an Al Pacino impression?
a transformation from one thing to the other.
And this also from LimeDB trivia. So,
yep.
Robert De Niro lobbying for the role of Vincent Mancini.
That seems insane.
Doesn't it?
Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If it said Francis Ford Coppola considered it, but eventually decided against it.
Yeah, no. That is all false.
But it worked so well for the second one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good time.
All right, so let's talk about the actual plot of the movie.
Yeah, let's do it. It starts with a what reminded me of a Breaking Bad intro, where we see kind of the wreckage of that helicopter attack, which we don't quite understand for, you know, a while later into the movie.
No, we see the wreckage of the old house, the Nevada house.
And then
we
get that is?
The wreckage mirrors that later after we get the helicopter.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they look so similar to me. I guess I confused the two.
Yeah, the movie opens with Michael writing a letter to his kids, and the only images we're seeing are the Nevada compound.
Right.
But totally run down, and Michael reveals he's been living in New York for 7 years, I think.
Yep. And with the letter being written.
Yeah, and that sort of brings us all together, and we get sort of this big celebration at the beginning of the movie
at the start of a Godfather movie?
Yeah, right?
No way.
I don't remember exactly what Michael is awarded, but it is a high award. Like,
yeah, it's Catholic. The Order of St. Andrew, maybe? I don't know, but it's...
You have way more biblical names in your name than I do, so...
Yeah. Yes, I do. Yeah. They say later on it's the highest award a layman can receive from the church, gotcha. So it's... You know, pretty much the best they can do unless you're a priest.
Yeah.
So it's very, very, a very well-regarded honor, I suppose.
Yeah.
And then we get our Vincent Mancini intro.
Yeah. Well, I think, the big crux of this movie is sort of, it takes a lot of what we've seen already as far as talking about, the link between... Well, I think sort of the first movie, it's very built on the link between gangsters and capitalism.
Yeah.
Just capitalism as a whole. The second movie is very much...
gangster and government?
Yeah, exactly. And this is very much gangster and religion.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great way to go. Like, I think that's sort of... I think the ideas of this movie are really, really great. And I think there are parts of this movie that I think are operating almost at the same level as Godfather 1 and 2 as far as, like, just well done. And I like the idea of Michael sort of trying to be clean. Like, he has his regrets and all that. And this whole movie is all about Michael trying to get out of the business, you know, and into business, you know. And there's I think that's so fascinating. It's such a fascinating arc. And I mean, very early on, we get sort of that shot that I love of a church right next to a skyscraper. And those are the only two things we see in the shot. And that's very much what the movie's all about. And I don't know. I think it's really interesting.
And, yeah. Well, and things, as you said, if we go business into kind of government in the first two, and then religion just brings it, kind of grounds it again and makes it something very personal. And
yeah.
We know it's for the Corleones and for... without unfairly generalizing, a lot of Italian people, religion is something very close to their hearts.
Yeah.
So, and this is him having to deal with all those personal things. Things have gotten very big. As you said, it's about him trying to go clean. He has that line in the second one where he says to Kay, in 5 years, the Corleone business is going to be completely legitimate.
Yeah.
This is him trying to make that really legitimate. And we see that in a very real way when he sells off all the shares to the casino and gives that back to all the people who helped him. He really is making a push for his business to go clean and at the same time himself to go clean. I mean, he goes to confession and he says he hasn't done that for 30 years. Like, he actually does seem to be trying to cleanse his soul in some way and repent for what he now sees as maybe some of the horrible things he's been doing to get his family to where they are.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you say it sort of allows for a smaller story, which it kind of does, but it also makes things bigger. Like, it's also, it's about something smaller and more personal, but it's also about a bigger thing.
Well, I know.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, you know? And I mean, it's a really nice... it's about religion, but also a lot of this plot centers around the Vatican, which is, you know, geographically small, but it is a very powerful body. It is a very rich body. It is a very influential body. It's its own country. Like, it's, you know, it's got all this money like a business. It's got, you know, government power, like the country we're talking about, number two. Like, it does sum up a lot of one and two. And yeah, you're right. It grounds it, but it also blows it up in a big way.
Yeah, for sure. And a lot of this movie is based on things I had no idea happened.
Yeah.
There was a pope that died very quickly upon being, upon trying to change things dramatically.
John Paul I was, he's known as the 30-day pope. He was alive for, he was pope for 33 days. I've never understood that one. But yeah, this.
So he's the Kim Campbell of popes?
Yeah, essentially. And so there's a lot of, you know, he was found dead sitting up in his bed with a cup of tea on his nightstand. So there's a bunch of conspiracy theories about, you know, what he did. And it was around the time that the Vatican Bank, which is kind of renamed in this one. But yeah, a lot of the Vatican story is based on true events, or at least inspired by true events, because it's a lot of things that, you know, obviously if there's a conspiracy theory involved, either it's never been settled or it's been settled in a way that isn't satisfactory for a lot of people. But a lot of the stuff about the Vatican's banker going missing, suspected suicide, being hung off a bridge with foreign currency in his pocket is all something that's absolutely true. Yeah. So you can't say this is based on a true story because no one's for sure what really happened. And obviously a bunch of other parts of this movie are completely false, but yeah it does have this grounding in a lot of 70s Vatican history, which I think is really fascinating and super boring at the same time. Like, it's hard to make it compelling, even though it's such an interesting story.
Yeah.
And I think they do an okay job of it in this one.
I think they do a pretty good job of it, because that's one thing that sort of struck me. I always remembered this as being the fastest paced of the three. And I don't totally agree with that now necessarily. Like, I think two is pretty fast paced, all things considered.
Yeah.
But this movie does move very swiftly for what is actually being accomplished, you know? Like,
yeah.
And it's just like, oh, he's just in Sicily now, you know? Like, and it's not like there weren't jarring transitions in the previous two films, but there's something about it that just feels speedier, you know?
Right.
But anyways, that's just such a weird abstract thing. But
yeah. Well, and going off the Vatican thing, I like the, I think it's a cardinal he's speaking to for the first time about
when he's
trying to make the deal.
Oh,
when he's offering him $500 million.
Oh yeah. Very early on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I like right when we kind of start getting introduced to the Vatican plot after the award's been given. I like the guy who plays that. I like his kind of frantic smoking. I think that really grounds this character as someone who's supposed to be really holy, who is caught up in an addiction and really kind of shaky and frantic about what's going on. And just stuff with the Vatican and church and religion overall is usually so stoic and collected and kind of idealized. But this one, we really see someone, as I said, frantic and shaking and can barely hold a cigarette and stuff. I really like that how they kind of ground and humanize the church and a lot of the people involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they highlight some of the illegal and immoral and non-Catholic things they do, but just on kind of an acting level and a personal level, I do like that performance a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I certainly like him as well. He reminds me of like this weird combination of Ian Holm and one of the bad guys from Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I just couldn't get that out of my head.
No one knows what you're talking
about. Yeah, people understand. People, you know who Ian Holm is.
I don't.
You wouldn't if you saw a picture.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. Use IMDb and look it up.
Okay, but how could I believe it, Ryan
Sorry,
Johnson?
Use Google Image Search to look it up.
Yeah. Trugal Image Search.
All right, so we've talked about how Michael's trying to get out of the business, and we've talked about
when he thought he was out, they pull him right back in.
There's a couple things that certainly aren't as iconic as other parts of this trilogy, but I think the scenes that certainly I know I referenced, and maybe this is just a hip hop thing, but the things I've got are. Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
That's a fairly famous one, even for the whole trilogy.
Okay,
I think
cool.
So.
That was sort of all like that. That was a thing I knew of before I saw this movie for sure. And
it's in Seinfeld, so
is it okay?
Yeah,
that makes sense. I wanted to talk about the scene leading up to it because it's the most violent scene in the trilogy, I think.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, yeah,
it's the. I mean, like. there might
body
be
body count. I think it has
exactly
to be.
There might be the same amount of bullets in Sonny's death, but the body count is way higher here. Yeah. And I think that whole the lead up to that scene, Michael talking about how he wants to get out, and talking to Eli Wallach's character, Altidore or something. I forget his name. Don Altidore maybe.
It is.
I'm thinking Josie Altidore. Can't be right.
Altobello.
Okay. Talking to him in the car, and the way they sort of, as you mentioned, he's like, "We're done, and here's your money from the casinos." And Joey Zaza is like, "No."
Yeah.
And
well, I mean, in that scene, I mean, that is right before that helicopter shooting. It's him giving away all the money. Like, yeah. It just happened. It's not like it's something he's thinking about. Like, he has carried it out, and then, you know. Handcuffed. Joey Zaza leaves. Altobello chases him out, which, and you know, we find out he was the traitor after. I think that was a really well done part of that scheme.
Yeah, for sure. I think he kind of tries to save Michael, though. I think that's part of it because he's trying to get Michael to come with him.
Yeah.
And the first, like, when I first rewatched it for this one, I was, you know, I didn't pay any mind to it because I totally forgot.
Yeah.
But when I was watching it again, I was trying to figure out if he's like actually trying to get Michael to come with him or if he's just trying to put on a good show.
Right.
And I can't imagine why he would try and put on a good show given
that. At that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Given that he certainly didn't expect anybody to live, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think he was actually trying to save Michael, like trying to get him to come with, you know?
Yeah. And it didn't seem like he had any real, you know, that much of a distaste for Michael. I think he just wanted the money more.
Exactly. Yeah. No, they were very clearly good friends. And, I don't think the $1 million he donates at the beginning of the movie is just, you know, pre-guilt money.
Yeah. 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 I really like the shooting a lot. I like the handcuffs on the doors. I think that's really cool. I think I've read a lot of people who just think that this is one of the moments that it goes over the top and mm-hmm. that a helicopter downtown shooting into a skyscraper is a little much, but I think it's awesome.
Yeah. Like, no, I think it's a really, really compelling scene or a really well-made scene. And I think, it does a really good job of setting the table for the rest of the movie. I like the setting. I like pretty much everything about it. I like Michael's escape. Like, yeah, I think it's a really well done action sequence.
Yeah.
You
know? So. Oh, and the escape with the just hot wiring the car and smashing the window.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, it's pretty muted, but even like Al sort of being like Mikey and just shooting out the door.
Yeah.
I think that's great, and I like that it allows us to get sort of the callback, which you mentioned, the wreckage from that shootout, of the wreckage of these families being a callback to the wreckage of the Corleones.
Right.
I love that. And even if that's the only thing that gunfight got accomplished, or sorry, massacre
yeah,
got
not
accomplished.
Not much of a gunfight.
Yeah. Then, yeah, it's pretty great.
Yeah, and I kind of see a callback to, you know, Michael taking out the heads of the five families
yeah.
and what
Joey
Zaza does by taking out this whole commission, or almost this whole commission, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, and it leads us to the scene we were talking about before, because we sort of get Michael, Al, Vincent, and I guess Connie's there as well.
Yeah.
Sort of sitting in a kitchen and talking about it, and we get sort of the, just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in, because he sort of, he has to retaliate, or sorry, he either has to retaliate or he's very concerned about his life.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I think it's a bit of both. I feel like he feels compelled to retaliate in some way.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to discuss the Vincent Mary?
Well, I want to talk about this scene more. Still,
okay. Go
because
for it.
I think I love this scene. I think it's really good. I think. This is far and away Pacino's worst performance in the trilogy, but like
his diabetes attack thing.
I love that part.
Oh, okay.
I think it's great. His when he yells "Thunder can't hurt," I love that. And it's like it's this amazing like I don't know. And
who else does he yell at that?
He yells Fredo. He yells the very end is him yelling Fredo. And there's a weird jump cut that leads into it that I wasn't crazy about. But I think it's just sort of like, I don't know. There's something about that scene that I really, really enjoy. And Thunder Can't Hurt is just a.
Yeah, I
there's
honestly,
something about that. That
I was
I just
honestly
love.
On the fence about that whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can see that.
I still don't know about it.
Yeah. I could certainly see that. But
You said it's his worst performance of the.
Of the trilogy, for sure.
Oh, this movie in general, not just that scene.
Yeah. No.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought you meant in that scene.
Yeah. I think there are parts where Pacino is good, but I think for the most part, he's very autopilot Pacino in this. Yeah. I think.
And this is the first one he didn't get a best actor or best actor or supporting actor nomination.
Yeah, Andy Garcia got nominated for an Oscar, so I don't know. Make a lying pun about the Oscars for me.
Literally nothing about the Oscars is true.
That'll do. Okay. But I like that scene. And I think it's this really nice moment of, and I mean, we're dealing with sort of, I don't know, maybe it's not cool to call it this, but sort of supernatural elements in this movie a little bit, you know, and just sort of the way religion is taken so seriously. And Michael's very much, very concerned about where he goes after life, and that's why he's trying to repent for his sins.
Yeah.
And I think there's sort of that nice little quick bit where it's just sort of like we get flashed into the old Michael, you know, but his thought process, you know. Yeah. Not the calm, collected Michael, but what is going on in his head when he's sitting there with his legs crossed, pouring himself some water. Yeah. You know? And I like that scene a lot.
Okay, so you say Pacino might be on autopilot in this one?
To an extent. You know, B-grade Pacino is still A-grade for anything, yeah. You know?
Do you feel that, and maybe this is part of where that feeling comes from, do you think that there's a large and unbelievable change between the Michael of Godfather 1 and 2 versus the Michael in Godfather 3? Like, with his need to repent and his crying and just some of the things that we see him do that we don't see him do in the first two. Do you think it's too much of a change, or do you think he's at a point in his life and he's seen so many things that it is believable?
I believe it. Yeah. That's never my problem with the movie. And you have to remember how much time passed. I mean,
yeah,
a week passed between us watching these movies together, you know.
Yeah.
16 years have passed between these two movies.
Don't ask me.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. I don't know if it's actually 16 of story, but I know this movie starts in 79.
Yeah.
So it would make sense that it's at least close.
Right.
But yeah, no, I think I like it. And one thing I really like about Pacino's performance in this movie is just the way he's framed. He's not always made to look very small, but I mean, Pacino's not a large man, but they don't try and hide his lack of stature, I guess. And the way he uses his posture in this movie is very, very good. Along, you know, similarly to how he did in the first two movies, but he's very hunched over a lot, and in a way that I feel like is subtle and helps his performance for sure, and helps the movie.
How do you like his stuff with Kay in this one?
I like it. I think it's interesting that he sort of doesn't grovel, but is kind of like, come on back, you know, like, he doesn't say he needs you or he needs her, but he certainly wants her back. And I love when he just takes off the hat and he's like, when they're going to do that driving tour. Of Sicily. He's like, it's me. Like, I think that's great. And a really great moment of Happy Michael, which we don't see once in the second movie, and really haven't seen since Connie's wedding.
Yeah, exactly. We see them get along at Connie's wedding, but we don't see them have fun.
Like, yeah.
This is the first time we see something fun for them.
Yeah, so. Exactly. It's still a very cautious setting because it's the first time she's meeting his family and all that.
And he just came back from the war.
Yeah, exactly. I like their stuff together, and I sort of... this is sort of the most human we see Michael, and...
Oh, yeah.
I like that. I like that aspect. And I think Kay, all the stuff with Kay really drives that home. I love the scene when they get back from that that trip, and Don Tomasino has died while they're gone, and Michael finds out, and he's like, and you know, Kay was sort of like, you know, being won over at least a little bit, and then she's like, it just never stops.
Yeah.
And then just leaves. I love that.
They're having such like, it's, other than
it's a 20-minute rom-com in the middle of this movie.
Yeah, no, other, but it's such a heart-to-heart they're having, other than, you know, the it was an abortion in number two. Like, this is kind of the most sincere, honest talk they have.
Yep.
And it's so much more positive than the one about their unborn child being killed. So it seems sweet, and you know, they admit to kind of always loving each other, and then at the most inopportune / most appropriate time, their personal relationship is put on hold or ruined for another vengeance murder needs to be carried out. Right?
Exactly. And Kay is just very quickly like, okay, done.
Oh, yeah. She's like, I'm not going to fight this. It's I can't believe I even tried to come back to this, let alone do that again, right?
Yeah, but it's not like, you know, Kay never talks to Michael again for the rest of the movie. It's not like she flees Sicily and she's with them at the end and all that. But I like all the Kay stuff.
Yeah, and one Michael and Kay thing I really like is when Vincent's just named Don and they start kind of planning stuff and he's getting his hand kissed and stuff and they leave the room. And it kind of reminds me as a callback of the very iconic shot at the end of the first one of the door being closed on Kay.
Yep.
We see a big door being closed, and now Michael and Kay are on the other side of it.
Yeah, well, it's Michael and Connie in the
right, right, right.
And the thing I actually really love about that shot is that the door's not being shut on Michael. Michael's leaving and then shutting the door, and I think that's awesome.
Yeah,
I think that's so cool.
Yeah, he's just handed away his role as Don, and he doesn't look sad to be leaving it.
Yeah,
like he's like, I'll close the door on my way out. You guys can deal with all this. I'll try to forget what an awful person I've been for the longest time.
Yeah, for sure.
How do you feel about Vincent getting the Don role? Believable? Too easy?
I guess it's believable.
Lack of other options.
Yeah, that's part of it. And Sonny would have led the Corleones, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he says, doesn't he say that?
I couldn't remember if he says that or says Dad never wanted me to leave. Oh, that would be Fredo saying that.
And number two, I think Michael says, if I go, like, he does make him, does put Sonny in charge of a lot of things when he goes off to Vegas.
No, Sonny's the guy that dies at the beginning.
Oh, right.
In the first movie.
Tom, yeah.
Because I feel like it makes sense, because I do feel like, because Vito didn't want Michael in the family at all.
Yeah.
He certainly wouldn't let Fredo run the family, and he wouldn't let a woman run the family either.
So if Sonny hadn't died, it would have been him.
It would have been Sonny. So I think it does make sense. And
it's his kid.
Yeah.
Yep.
He would just sort of have to, I'm sure Vito would have at some point tried to calm Sonny's anger a bit.
Yes.
So let's talk incest, because we have to talk about it, because this movie totally ignores it. And it's always there, and it's so weird.
It doesn't
totally ignore it,
but
it ignores it way too much.
Yeah, to the point where I feel like if it wasn't mentioned once, I'd be like, there's just something I'm not getting here.
Yeah.
Even though I understand.
They're not actually cousins.
Yeah, even though I understand this whole family tree, there has to be something I'm just not getting.
Yeah.
Or if this took place 300 years ago instead of like 30 years ago, then I'd be fine with it.
Yeah, no, it's just like they just have to get their George Michael and maybe on, and it's very bizarre.
And it's, I mean, there's a lot of family touching and kissing throughout all these movies, and you're just like, oh, that's Italian culture. But then when they start, like, it gets kind of dicey. And then when they have that scene where they're cooking together and holding hands, you're just like, okay, we're doing this, we're going all out. How do you say Cousin de Giroux in Italian? That's what we're getting into here.
But they're just first cousins. That's what Amanda Seyfried taught me. It's fine.
So I'll love him first? What?
Yeah, that line's insane.
Yeah, that is just like it being presented to you so boldly and clearly, and you like spinning it and be like, yeah, but I love him. No, absolutely not.
I love my cousin the most. No, just don't love your cousin. No, love your cousin, but just not with the banging, like.
Yeah, and it's not like it's
no romantic love with your cousin.
And it could have been maybe kind of like a Montague Capulet's, like, he loves a girl from one of the rival gangs or something, and make it a little, like, West Side Story thing.
Exactly, and I think, like,
but it's the same family, and there's not, the conflict is supposed to be kind of the, probably a better word for it, but what comes to mind is like the Spider-Man thing, where if you love Mary Jane, like if you love anybody, they're gonna find out and they're gonna go after her.
Yeah.
So that's what Michael's trying to say to him, right? It's like, you can't love my daughter because the risk you'll put her at by loving her.
Yeah.
Also, it's your fucking cousin.
Yeah. First, it's your cousin. Yeah, and I think that's the weirdest part about this plot line to me, is that the very mild things it accomplishes could have definitely been accomplished by Vincent not being Sonny's kid.
Yeah.
You could have just made him Clemenza's kid,
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, we trust him. Sure, he's a Corleone now. Like, and I mean, we've seen Hagen in previous movies kind of be adopted as a Corleone. And,
yeah.
And
even if it was Hagen's kid, well, it would be weird. Yeah. That would be super Arrested Development.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I think it's just, it doesn't accomplish anything they couldn't have accomplished without the movie. Or sorry, without the that Incest. Relationship. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's very bizarre.
But. Yeah, I don't like it.
No. I can't imagine anybody does. And the weirdest thing about this movie that I find is I feel like it's a really, for Coppola, I feel like this is the most personal of the Godfather movies.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's very much about a father loving a son, or sorry, well, I mean, kids, but daughter specifically.
Yeah.
And
fucking your cousin.
Well, that's where it becomes weird. I want to do more research about Coppola's wife now, but. And the fact that Francis Ford Coppola's father, even though he was a musician, wanted his son to be an engineer. And I sort of found that kind of interesting, because I was thinking about that during the movie. And I was like, wait, Carmine Coppola is a musician. So maybe it was him to his father. And then yeah. I looked it up and
kind of
Carmine wanted Francis to be an engineer. I was like, oh, that's very interesting.
That is weird.
And yeah, no, I think it's sort of, and also the fact that it's very much sort of looking back at your past legacy as well. And
yeah.
Yeah, I think it's kind of the most interesting to think about as far as Coppola's career, not yeah. necessarily as filmmaking, but as a person, I think it's interesting.
Well, yeah. And in reference to him kind of thinking he was done with this Godfather series.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Being pulled right back in. Yeah. I think that's funny.
By capitalism.
You know what else is weird about this movie? Stabbing someone in the throat with their own glasses.
Yeah. It's pretty badass, though. I can't imagine how it works. But,
yeah, I'd hate to gamble on it, though.
Like, yeah. Well, maybe he like snuck in and followed him during lunch or whatever. Yeah, he just sort of prepped a shank without him noticing.
Yeah, it's weird.
Well, let's talk about that action sequence then, because I think it's great. I think that 20-minute sort of sequence where there's all the sneaking around the opera house and Al murdering the Archbishop and the banker dying and the other Don, like what was the guy with the Lucchesi or something?
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that's a really, really great sequence. And I think it's better than the ending of Godfather 2, like as far as that sort of style of sequence that they do. And
right.
I might like it better than the ending of Godfather 1 with I like the idea of killing off the five families better, but as far as execution, I find that really, really good. Like, really well done.
I think it's cool. I think it benefits a lot from being more centralized than the other ones. Like, sneaking around the opera house and, like, the guards. And then Michael didn't even know he had a sniper rifle aimed at his heart at one point.
Yeah, and even added in.
And his son's right there. Like, if he gets shot, his kids, his family and his wife, his kids' first performance. Like, you know, there's so much riding on it instantly. Obviously, there's a lot riding on the similar sequences in the first two, but I just find that it's in the same building. It's so contained. I think that really just ups the stakes a lot.
Yeah, and another element that I didn't even mention is Connie killing the other Don.
Yeah.
By way of cannoli. And I think that adds a nice little element as well. You're correct. And the fact that, you know, once the sequence is over, you sort of feel like, okay, maybe they're safe, and very much not. And I think that's sort of the most sort of, that's the only time in the trilogy, I think, where we sort of get, you know, like, oh, this action sequence is over, and then it's like, no.
I can't think of another one that's as much of like a, you know, like a horror movie second scare right before the bad guy really dies, right?
And it doesn't feel cheap in the movie. It's sort of like, well, we've got 9 hours built up of trust for you at this point, you know, like you're okay with this one, you know? And I remember finding it very, very surprising. When I first watched the movie, I remembered it this time, but, Mary's death, I thought was very surprising. It was very, I mean, obviously a very dark scene, you know, and it's really intense. And, I like it. Like, as far as what it adds to the film, I think it's pretty great.
I don't like exactly how she dies. Like, I don't have a problem with her dying.
Yeah.
I don't like
the second bullet thing and then her still standing.
Yeah, and dropping and dad and all that stuff. I'm not nuts about that, but yeah. I think it's that she died, I think, was a good choice. Francis Ford Coppola said that a lot of people were attacking Sofia Coppola's performance as a way to get to him, yeah. and not really to her. And I think that's so funny with the way that she literally takes a bullet for her father yeah. in this movie. I think yeah. that's super appropriate. I want to ask you about, you know, because you compared this to, obviously, the similar scenes from the 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
And we already mentioned that, again, this movie starts with a big celebration. Do you think that this is too much of a retread of the last two movies? Or do you think that it's, you know, it's kind of made its own little mini genre in place of those conventions? Because we have that, the celebration at the start, we have kind of a semi-montage slash murder spree. You know, while the Corleones are attending an event, someone killed at a street festival, Johnny Fontaine again.
Yeah.
Getting someone into the family picture right before. Like, we have all these things, Michael dancing again with someone, mm-hmm. tracking down the traitor and killing them. Like, we have all these things we've seen before, sometimes twice before in two movies. Do you think it's too much?
No, because when I was watching The Godfather 2 and it started out with a celebration, I was like, oh, this again. And then, you know, the way they do the Hyman Roth's murder and stuff at the end of 2, I was like, oh, yeah. they're doing this again. By the third time, it's like this is how it's done. This is how you make a Godfather movie. So I think yeah, that problem...
It doesn't seem redundant. It just seems to be filling in.
It feels right in Godfather 3. It's more... It seems weird to say this because Godfather 2 is... such a better movie, but it feels more like a retread in Godfather 2 than it does in Godfather 3, just because I would find it weird if the first half hour of the Godfather 3 wasn't some sort of celebration at a Corleone residence, you know?
Yeah.
And
I mean, as we've said, they do it well in this one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, in all three films, they really use that half hour party at the beginning to really set, and it is very close to half an hour in each movie.
Yeah.
And
I can't do math. I wouldn't know.
Yeah. And it really sets the table for what comes after. And the tying up of the loose ends is how these things sort of end. Like, you just tie them all up at the same time, and it's this really sort of satisfying ending. And that's also what makes Mary's death so good, is that it breaks the cycle. And I mean, you could say the same thing about Fredo's death at the end of Godfather 2, but that's very that really feels like it's coming. Like, more like, will Michael do this? But we don't see Mary's death coming at all, really.
Yeah, you know, Michael says in number 2, you know, probably an hour of runtime before, I don't want anything to happen while Mom's still alive.
Yeah.
And then Mom's still alive. So you, like, there's all the steps leading up to Fredo's death.
Exactly.
And maybe he does, maybe he doesn't do it, but that's always something that's supposed to be present in your mind. Whereas Mary, I mean, I guess it gets mentioned that, you know, Michael wants Vincent to stay away from her because of the danger that puts her in, but
yep.
it seems like he sticks to that rule. Even right before her murder, he sends her away and says, you know, like, run along, this isn't happening. I made a deal. You kind of think, oh, well, she's safe because Michael impressed on him that you can't do that.
Yeah.
He seems to be following the rules, and I guess she'll be fine. And then people get shot, and you're like, oh, I guess she's fine. And no, she isn't.
She's definitely not. Yeah. Yeah. And what do you feel about the Michael Corleone silent scream?
I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen it in some other things. I think it's effective. Yeah, when we do hear his scream, it's pretty heart-wrenching and horrible.
Yes.
And they kind of put the sound back in.
Yeah. And, like, I don't know if it's supposed to be, if, like, on those steps, Michael is screaming the whole time, or if he's just sort of, like, not screaming and then screams.
Right.
I think it's more what I'm describing than just sort of a sound design thing.
Yeah.
I feel like it's sort of, like, Michael's so used to keeping things internal, keeping things quiet, like, and then it's just sort of like, fuck it, my daughter's dead. I'm just belting it out.
Yeah.
And it's a really tough moment. And I find the last few minutes of this movie, like, surprisingly emotional, from like going from that cry, and the fact that you just don't see part of that, I will admit, is Al Pacino. Like the fact, like how much I like Al Pacino, that I can't remove that from it.
Yeah.
Just sort of you don't see Al Pacino that sort of broken, and
not often.
No, yeah. And I find that fascinating. And the fact that it goes into the, I mean, we've already been teased with the Apollonia dance earlier, but Apollonia, Mary, and Kay, and that transitioning into him sitting in the chair by himself and dying by himself. I think it's just such a really, really good, tight 2 minutes that ends the movie on such a down note. And yeah. I think an appropriate note, and it sort of like closes a cycle, you know, it sort of closes Michael Corleone's story. And we had the prequel to Michael Corleone's story, and now we've got a definitive end.
Yeah.
You know, who knows what Vincent's doing, but Michael's done. And these are very much stories of Michael. And
yeah. And we talked in, I guess in the first podcast we did about, you know, what we compared Vito Corleone to Carmela. Mm-hmm. His mother. And so in that first scene, she's the one out singing and having fun and yeah. eating and enjoying the wedding, and Vito's inside taking care of business. And just, you know, we've talked about kind of the gender roles in this trilogy and how, you know, usually the women are the ones who get to do the fun, happy stuff, and the men are the ones who have to do, you know, this kind of dark, shady business side yeah. of things. And, you know, we get, as you said, when we get through those dances, we get Kay and Apollonia and even Mary, who Michael very much protects from the sketchy side yeah. of things, and who even Vincent says, oh, Michael didn't do, like, Michael's not the guy people say, like, he's not this violent, he wouldn't kill Fredo, it's all a misunderstanding, things like that. When we go through those three things, then we see Michael alone, and we just see that he's lost all the women in his life, which, you know, women in this movie kind of represent the happiness and the joy and the personal side of life, and he's had moments with all of them, but through the way he's run his business and ran his life, he's lost all of them in
yeah.
one way or the other, whether it be through murder or divorce or whatever it is, whatever the situation is with Kay by that point. I was going to ask you if you thought it was too quick to go from Mary's death to, how long is that shot of old Michael? Like,
not long.
It's like less than 30 seconds of kind of like establishing he's there and then him falling over and croaking. Yep.
I don't think it's too fast, because I think the other two Godfathers end very quickly as well.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, I think it sort of works with the flow of these movies. And the last shot of Michael is, I think, adequately long.
Okay.
The wide shot where he falls. I love that he's not given like a graceful just die in a chair. Yeah. I love that he
ugly
falls
and awkward
over
and just uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah, and that he falls over and that the chair falls over as well is so important to me. It's sort of like just
the throne.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just done. It's yeah. over. And yeah, I think the shot that really matters, I think, is long enough.
Okay.
I'm fine. You know, if you think the establishing shot of his, or I guess the establishing close up of his face
yes.
to say that he's older, I think, you know, you can make an argument that it's too short, but it doesn't bother me at all.
What happens between Mary's death and Michael's death, or is the fact that he's alone at the end render it meaningless?
It certainly doesn't render it meaningless, but it renders it unimportant, you
okay.
know? Because I think it's very, it's conceivable that Vincent would, you know, just be like, Kay's gone. Like, out of the equation.
Well, she kind of wanted out already.
Exactly.
Having her daughter murdered in front of her.
Yeah, Vincent probably would sort of, like, you know, keep money flowing to Michael, just out of just a respect thing. And so he would probably be set up for life, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't think he's the only person on that property. I think he's got servants and stuff like
that.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
He's certainly living a the life of a rich person, I
yes,
think.
But alone in the meaningful
exactly.
ways. Yeah.
And but I don't think Vincent's the kind of guy that would just come by and hang out. And I mean, even we see Michael visiting Don Tomasino so infrequently
yeah.
in the trilogy. Yeah, Kay's gone. I think it's all about Tony, or Anthony, if he comes back or not. That's kind of the only question. If he sort of disowns his father, or if he's like, well, I'll still let you be my father. Like, you've become more important now that my sister's dead. But
and I can't see Tony doing a Michael, like,
no, definitely
rejecting
not.
Rejecting his father to a point, but then being pulled back in.
Yeah.
Oh, no chance.
No chance. And I think that's made very clear in a way that he's like, I'm not going to be a part of this. But him saying that to his father, as opposed to him saying that to Kay, you know, which is what Michael says. Michael never tells Vito, I'm not doing this, you know?
Yeah.
It's right, always right. Like, he's like saying it to himself. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this. And Vito would have been fine with that. Vito wanted better things or whatever. But, I mean, Vito kind of wanted him in the family, but certainly not at the place that he ended up having. But, yeah, no, I think, you know, it's all about whether or not Anthony is still okay with his dad being who he is. And
yeah.
I think he could flip a coin. I think it's 60-40 that he's not okay with his father, and Michael really does die alone.
Right. Any interest in Godfather 4?
Nope. Well, okay, I guess that's a lie, because if it existed, I would see it immediately. Yeah, so I guess there is certainly interest. I would prefer if there wasn't.
Especially the version that Andy Garcia talked about. Yeah.
What is that? Oh, no. Oh, this sounds like something I'm definitely not into.
No, it is. I promise it's something you're into. So it'd be a lot like Godfather 2. So we have the two eras.
Yeah.
We have Vincent running the Corleone family, like picking up after Godfather 3. So he's, you know, essentially Vito from the first one, or Michael from 2 and 3 running the family. But then we also have the parallel story of Sonny and him coming up.
Mm.
Sonny being played by Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, pass. Hard pass.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't like this at all.
Anything else about the Godfather trilogy?
No, we've already ended on a sufficient down note like the Godfather 3 does, so I think we might as well wrap it up.
Cool.
Thank you for listening to the McGuff Men. Again, check out all of our other podcasts this week. I don't think I mentioned that we did a mini-sode, or James did a mini-sode on GTA 5.
With Brett.
But that happened. Pretty and damn. we're taking next week off because of how much we've been doing recently. But yeah, we'll be back after a week for something else. Who knows what? But
send in your requests if you have anything you want us to do.
Okay. But yeah, definitely not a Godfather podcast next time we're back. So thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.